great to have you here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's all about you and that wallet of yours. I want you to learn ideas from me so you can keep more of what you make. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're in the midst of open enrollment season for healthcare. I've got a special warning for you about people getting scammed with fake insurance. And coming up yet later, there's a new theory that you should start saving for a kid's college before you've even had a kid. That's how paranoid people are about college costs. I'm going to tell you how that's even possible to do and who should consider that, if anybody. I want to talk right now about something that was very popular after the housing bust, and that is people running out there and buying up failed properties. Homes that have been foreclosed, neighborhoods that were heavily abandoned, and people had what, in the time of hardship so many people experienced, there were others who were able to create a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get investment property at a very low price. And so I'm asked a lot now, is there still room in the marketplace with how home values have risen in many places in the country for you to be an owner of investment property, of rental property? And it is much harder now, but still doable. I have actually reduced the number of rental properties I have down to 3. And I used to have quite a few more. I have 7. Anyway, I'm down to 3. And I took advantage of the run-up in values to reduce the portfolio I had of rental properties. And that's because of the stage of life I'm at. But producer Joel, who is 34 now, has been buying property all along, even as property values have risen. And you bought your first property in what year?
2009.
So you were 25 years old.
26.
26.
Yep.
You bought your first.
And no, you're right. 25.
25. Thank you. I can count better than you. But you now have a total of how many properties? How many rental units?
3 single family homes and 1 duplex.
So you have 5 rentals.
Yep.
And you've been buying even through the recovery.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I feel like there are a lot of people that have that question as home prices recover. Well, isn't this a time for me to sit on the sidelines and not look into buying rental properties? And I think for people that don't know what they're doing, there's probably some truth to that. But for people that do know what they're doing, have researched, or maybe have already have a rental property or two, I think still, if you are a smart shopper, I think there are deals to be had in any market. And I think there are deals to be had in a market like we're in now as well.
Well, let me first set that Joel works in radio, that it's not a high-paying profession. You didn't come from money. You and your wife share the same values. You've been very good about living below your means, and you have sacrificed things in your own life, the two of you together, and that's a choice you've made to free up money to be able to seize opportunities when they were there for rental properties. And you have a total of 5 now, right?
Right.
5 units. And you have bought a rental property as recently as the last year.
Right, yeah, just within the last few months.
So here we are at a time where prices have rebounded heavily. In many places, they're above where they ever were before, even before the bust. And you're having to pay higher interest rates to buy properties now. Does it still make sense for you to be out looking and looking for opportunity? And what do you look for if you still think it's worth not just going to the sidelines?
Yeah, so for me, I have to save up every time in order to get to that 25% down payment level, which to me is kind of a magic number that if I can't afford that, then there's no point in me buying the property. And so since I literally just bought one a couple of months ago, it's going to take a while for me to kind of get that savings back up to where I have that money for a down payment on another rental home. So I'm not looking nearly as actively now. And even on the last purchase a couple months ago, I was looking, but the deals were a lot harder to find, right? In 2009, 2010, 2011, it's kind of like shooting fish in a barrel. It was like super easy to find a fairly inexpensive property that you could do well on as a landlord. And now it takes a lot of work, and you know, you're hard pressed to find a good deal. So I've been looking, and I found this great duplex, and it met kind of all my parameters, but there weren't very many properties hitting the parameters that I was looking for, you know, over the past year, you know, while I was searching.
But what's important is one of your parameters is every property you have bought when you were 25 forward has been one that you have been profitable in, cash flow positive from the first month's rent of a tenant.
Yeah, that's definitely important to me. And I think it's easy to look at other avenues for making money on a property. In particular, you know, speculating about the value that you're going to get, the equity that you're going to be able to build in that rental home. And I think there's definitely something to be said for buying something that you think is going to appreciate. But on top of that, you want to make sure that your rental property is cash flowing, cash flow positive, because if it's not, I mean, when you get a call about a broken toilet or light fixture or whatever it may be, man, if I'm not making any money every month, like, it doesn't get me out of bed to go fix the issue. And so, so having a property that does cash flow every month, I think is really important.
And over these 9 years, have you had to evict anybody yet?
I haven't had to evict anyone. And so I think to the process that you go through when you're screening a tenant is so crucial. And it's the number one step that doesn't take all that long to do it well. But so many people fall down on just a couple of the ways that you can screen a tenant well and a couple of the key things to look for. And if you fall down on that thing, on that step of the process, you need to just spend an extra 30 minutes or an hour in the tenant screening, because that will save you potentially, you know, hours or months of headache further down the road and thousands of dollars in eviction costs. So fortunately, I've not had that problem. And I think a lot of it is due to just stringent screening.
Well, good for you. And you, as soon as you are able to build that reserve back up, you're out there again?
You know it.
Do you have a goal of how many properties, or is it all about just finding the right deal year by year?
Yeah, for me at this point, it's all about finding the right deal in the right place that kind of matches what I'm looking for, and kind of keeping it close to home. I like to have all my properties nearby that I can easily manage, in parts of town that I care about, that I want to see thrive. And it's not necessarily about building this giant empire. It's about having this small stable of properties that I can manage that will eventually one day pay for me to live.
Actually, you're already on your way with that. The tenants are paying off the mortgages on each of these properties. I'm always about diversification. Have you neglected saving money in retirement plans?
No, I haven't. I've tried to save a lot in my 401k and my Roth every year as well. I haven't been nearly as diligent as I'd like to on my Roth, just because I've prioritized real estate over that at this point. But yeah, we'll see. Hopefully I'll be able to put a little more in the actual retirement accounts away too.
And I should point out that you have two young children and your wife principally works in the home. So you're doing all this on just your low radio salary.
Yeah, true.
Fantastic. James joins us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, James.
Hi, Clark. How are you?
Great, thank you. You're going to Carnegie Hall.
I am. It's actually our sixth trip over the last 20 years.
Wow, my great niece just performed at Carnegie Hall.
That's outstanding. Very cool. Well, we are trying to raise some funds to pay for the bus to get there. It's already an expensive trip, and I'm trying to help my kids out by getting the bus paid for through funding locally. And I often ask our local businesses to help us out. This year, I'm thinking about doing it with an online funding website, and was a little disappointed to find out how much they charge for those things. And I wanted to get your opinion on the format, but also on whether there's some cheaper ones.
So you're thinking like a YouFundMe kind of thing?
Exactly.
So, I mean, what they do is they allow virtually anybody to put together a campaign, and you spread the publicity on social media and email and however you could in your community. and then people go to the GoFundMe page or whatever competitor you would use, and they donate the money, and then you get a net of, is it 97% of what they donate?
That's correct, with the company that you mentioned.
Right. So
I haven't checked out on the others yet.
That's not considered to be a large amount of money to take out from the fundraising effort.
Okay.
So 97 cents out of every dollar somebody donates towards the bus, going towards the bus, is pretty efficient. You know, they have potentially merchant fees and other expenses for running the operation, that 3% is within the realm of being reasonable.
Okay.
How are you going to promote it, though, that to be able to get people to donate to get you the money? Like, how much money is it going to take for the bus?
The bus costs around $10,000, give or take $1,000, depending on the year and gas prices. And I don't have to raise every single little bit of it. We do some performing around town, and people donate money as well. So it's not like we just have to use this one source, but I'd like to get as much of it as possible through this method. I'm thinking primarily Facebook, but I could still send my letter drive out and just not have the return envelope already pre-stamped. That would save some money. I usually send a letter out with a self-addressed envelope back.
But you give people now, you give people the ability on their phone or on a laptop to contribute right then and there. Your response rate is almost certainly higher, even if you had a self-addressed stamped envelope included.
Oh, okay.
Because people are much more likely today to donate online, where it just takes them a second, then the act of pulling out a checkbook and writing a check stops, I would guess, at least two-thirds of people now are not going to go forward with making a contribution if they have to go through the process of writing a check.
We've gotten pretty lazy, haven't we?
Well, it's just things change over time, and people like to do it differently today, and I hope you're successful with the fundraising and the kids get to take the trip.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Today's Clark Regis moment is like a look back to what used to happen in the bad old days last decade when you were trying to buy health insurance.
Scams, rip-offs, outrages. It's a Clark Regis moment.
Oh, okay. I got a special warning for you. This is from federal authorities, including federal agencies, the courts, and the rest. There was a con game going on, and just a terrible ripoff where people were being marketed what they thought was health insurance, signing up for policies and paying premiums. And then when they'd go to the doctor, they had nothing. People were not buying these individual policies on the state federal exchange, the healthcare.gov exchange. People were buying them from people marketing them using terms like Trump Care, Obamacare, using logos of insurers that people know, according to the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, and people were being conned out of huge money. The perpetrators behind this We're all about living large. Rolls Royces, Lamborghinis, private jets, gambling in Vegas, oceanfront condos, $1 million in jewelry, on and on and on. And all these people who thought they had health insurance had nothing. I need for you to know a couple of warning signs here. One, if you don't buy on healthcare.gov during open enrollment, who knows if you're dealing with a true legitimate insurer? If you don't want to buy on healthcare.gov and you're looking outside of that, and somebody doesn't, in this case, nobody was being provided with actual policy documents. And they'd ask for them, they'd be told, oh, we'll send you those. Big warning sign. They weren't licensed to sell insurance. Another warning sign. And as far as the logo of insurers, if you buy insurance and you're issued an insurance card for an actual insurance company that's well-known and recognized, and you are able to go sign up on their portal, you know you have insurance, right? But be very aware and wary, because this is a bad movie that's in rerun. Because I'm telling you, this was so much something that I heard about from you last decade, people getting swindled by fake health insurance. Don't let it happen to you, as we're in a time that's hard for people to understand exactly how health coverage works. Just remember this, as an individual, you can look at buying through one of the co-ops run by religious organizations. You can look at buying on the healthcare exchange, again, healthcare.gov. And you will have, in some states, the ability to buy direct from an insurer for plans that are non-compliant. That means they don't cover pregnancies, they don't cover cancers, they don't cover a lot of illnesses, diabetes, whatever. They're minimal coverage plans. But know the con artists, the fake people are out there. It's ugly. Be careful. Ask the right questions. If it doesn't seem right as you're talking to them, it probably isn't right. I'm so glad you're with us here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you learning ways to keep more of what you make. I saw a headline in the Washington Post, and when I saw this, I started laughing. The headline is, "Should you start saving for college even before your child is born?" Gosh, that speaks to how much trauma there is in parents and guilt about how they're ever going to be able to afford a kid's college education, a kid that doesn't even exist yet, but they may plan to have in the future. So it is actually, there's a loophole where you could start saving for a kid before that kid even exists, or before you're even pregnant. And it's where you set up a 529 college savings plan, tax-free savings plan, that you own, and you name yourself for now as the beneficiary, as a placeholder. And then once you have kids, then you can change the name of the beneficiary without any tax implications to the name of that future child. So that's how you can do it. But the question is not, can you? The question is, as it was written in the Washington Post, should you? No, almost never. Why? Because first, you want to make sure that you're doing all the savings you should for your own financial security in your own life. What does that include? If you have a retirement plan at work, until you're saving the absolute max you can in that plan, don't even think about saving for a child's college, whether that child is born yet or not. Second, if you're eligible, fully fund a Roth IRA for you and your spouse. Again, that comes before saving for a kid's college. If you're HSA eligible, fully fund the HSA plan before you put a dollar aside for a kid's college. Now, that's pretty radical talk from me compared to what you might hear elsewhere. But the reason is, There are no scholarship plans for your retirement. You have to fund your retirement. You have to fund your rainy day. And so for college, there are so many options. Kid can go in the military and potentially later have college for free or a greatly reduced cost. Kid can go to community college in many states now for all 4 years and get a college degree potentially for under $10,000 total for 4 years. Texas was a pioneer in the four-year degree for 10 grand. Florida, very much in the forefront of having community colleges converted to four-year campuses that are commuter schools. No professors doing research. Professors are all in the classroom. Instructors are all in the classroom. Everything's about teaching the student at a low cost. Scholarships, work, so many different ways to pay for it. If you've met all the other financial goals and you want to save in a college savings plan, great. Even if the child you hope to have someday isn't born, yes, you can open that 529. Just make sure it's the right one. There are great guides to setting up a 529 plan and knowing which plans are best to go into, because there are a lot of terrible plans. There are some okay plans and then several great plans. I've just updated my ratings on 529 plans, and I have a guide that tells you which ones are good, which ones are not, which investments to go into. Others do these as well, Morningstar, Saving for College. The idea is don't let somebody sell you a 529 plan. You always choose the 529 plan, and never, 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 not ever, no exceptions, ever buy a 529 plan from a commission salesperson. No way, not any day. Andy is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Clark. How are you today?
Great, thank you, Andy. You got a question about your son and student loans.
Yes, he is considering, and I guess I am too, because I think he needs a co-signer, but he's considering refinancing his Stafford loans that he currently has. And he's looked into a couple companies, and I'm just not sure. I haven't even, you know, considered this before his conversation with me. So we're new at this and looking for some guidance.
So I don't recommend taking federal student loans and converting them into refied private loans.
Okay.
Because your son would be giving up a lot of consumer protections that come with a federal student loan that are not available with a private student loan. Are his are his Staffords at 6.8%?
No, they're actually, they range from 3.1 to 4.4.
Oh my goodness. If he were to refi, his rate would go up, not down.
Would go up. Okay.
Yeah, so
okay,
he definitely does not want to do anything with them as far as refiing, because he's got a sweetheart deal.
Okay. And I guess once, if you were to refinance with a private company, they're going to pay off these federal loans, and then you don't have any of those deferment options you may have if in the future you had unemployment come up with, you know, and unable to make a payment.
Right. Your son would lose all flexibility. He'd lose the flexibility of being able to, as an example, if you lose your job under the revised pay-as-you-earn system, you're considered to be current even if you can't pay anything, as long as you document that you're unemployed at that point. And the payments can go up or down based on your income for the life of the loans and how long you have to pay your loans on the federal system. It's based on what job category you're in, but your son is eligible for loan forgiveness of unpaid federal balances, typically after 10, 20, or 25 years, depending on his job classification when he took out his loans originally. So it would be a severe disadvantage. And I know he's probably getting barraged with offers in the mail saying, hey, refinance your student loans at 2.75% or whatever. Nobody gets those rates. Nobody.
Okay.
Unless they're a teaser rate for a period of time or a variable rate. And so he's got a good thing going. He shouldn't turn it into a bad thing.
Okay. Yeah, he just made his first payment. So, you know, he's looking at any way to save money. And he thought maybe he could do that going private. But I told him we would call you and find out the rest of the story. And I truly appreciate all your help and all you do for us.
Absolutely. I hope his degree got him a good job for that first paycheck and first payment.
He, you know what? Believe it or not, Clark, he got an outdoor recreation degree, if you've ever heard of that.
I have not.
And he is using it at a adventure boarding school in North Carolina, and he's living a dream.
Well, that is great. I hope he loves his experience doing that.
He seems to be loving it. And again, I appreciate all your help with all the topics. I listen to you every week.
Well, thank you very much. And I have a big bias. You know, I'll tell you from time to time, Andy, about all the jobs that are in the greatest demand, that are paying the most money, that employers are begging for workers and all that. And sometimes when I get into that, it's like I forget the heart side of things. And the reality is, the most important thing in life is to do what you love. And that's just what your son's doing. Jose is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Jose.
Hey, hello, Howard. Thank you for taking my call.
It's my pleasure.
All right. So, great show. I've been listening for years.
Thank you.
So, this is my dilemma. I'll be retiring probably in 6 years if I go for the 67 and plus retirement. And I'm debating whether to roll over the pension that I have with a former employer. And the reason I've been losing like $300 a month roughly until I reach that age, actually forever. And the reason I'm going in that direction is because my former non-for-profit employer was bought out by a for-profit employer. And from what I read, pensions are not secure. I seem to be more concerned with a for-profit than a non-for-profit funded pension.
All right. So with a pension, most pensions are insured by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
Okay.
And if the acquiring employer went insolvent and they close their doors and they go bust and they can't meet the pension obligation, in most cases, the pension would come from the semi-governmental Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, and it's backed up by the taxpayers. So unless you were getting a monstrously large pension, you would not likely see what's known as a pension haircut if your pension plan at the former place went bust. So
okay.
I don't know that you need to necessarily worry. Do you have a pension plan document?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So there...
Yes, I fill out all the terms. Yes. Go ahead.
All right. So in that document, you likely will have information about the plan itself and how it's administered, what the plan's official name is. And if you go to pbgc.gov for Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, you should be able to talk with PBGC, say that five times, and find out whether or not your plan is one that would be covered by the Pension Benefit Guarantee if the plan did go insolvent.
Right.
Because usually you're going to get a better benefit if you let the clock run and then once the pension starts, letting them just send you a check every month.
Right. Yeah, that was what I wanted to do. But again, the for-profit intervention made me a little nervous. But
Do you have reason to believe that they're unstable now?
No, actually... What got me worried was that when during the process of the takeover, you know, all that time that they're talking to the politicians and everyone in town about the takeover, they said, we will fund the pension. And it sounded like, why is that even, for me, it sounded like, why is that even a choice? I mean, is that something that them to do?
Okay, so what's happening around the country is companies, especially when one company buys another, if they're a company without a pension plan and they buy one with, they usually do what's called a pension plan termination, or they will sell the pension plan to an insurance company. And then the insurance company becomes the responsible party to pay you out over the rest of your life. But if there's no reason for you to be concerned that they are going to fail financially, I don't know there's any real worry you should have, especially if you follow the steps I'm talking about with verifying with the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation that your pension is going to be a protected one. And if it's a protected one, then I would not lose a second sleep about this. Wait the 6 or 7 years till you're going to retire, and then start that monthly check coming every single month for the rest of your life, which is why pensions are so great. It's time for Ask Clark. Our producer, Joel, asked me a question that you posted at clark.com.
All right, Sandy wrote in and she said, I know you've discussed this before, but what's your advice on prepaid funeral arrangements?
I do not like prepaid funerals. And in fact, I was stopped in a restaurant by two ladies that work for one of the big funeral home chains that were very upset with me about my objection to prepaying for funerals. And my objections are many. Number one, the arrangements we think we want for when we pass away someday change with so many people so much over a lifetime. What we might want today, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, we may wish for an entirely different thing. Second, over the course of a lifetime, we may expect that we're going to live in a particular location our whole life. But then things happen in life, and we might move somewhere else. And there you prepaid for a funeral. The national chains say, well, don't worry about it. We'll just transfer the money you paid to another location. But the industry has been unstable with bankruptcies of some of the big chains. And as a result, it is a risky thing for you to prepay. In addition to that, there's another thing I don't want you to prepay for, and that's cemetery plots. I know in my family, there are any of a number of plots that were purchased long ago that will never be used because we've scattered as a family geographically around the country. Some family members even live outside the United States. And in addition, when those cemetery plots were purchased, there was almost nobody in America who chose cremation. Today, in many parts of the United States, 70% of people are cremated. A much better thing to do rather than to do any kind of pre-purchase or pre-plan is instead join a local nonprofit funeral and memorial society. They're located not everywhere in the United States, but most of the United States is covered. You join your local chapter. The one that I'm a member of, I think, is $35 one-time fee for a lifetime membership. And some negotiate a price for you for various services. Others have arrangements where you get a discount from list, from a funeral home, participating funeral homes price list. It's done different ways. But the most important thing is whatever arrangements you want, however you want things done, communicate that to your loved ones. If you do choose to join a local funeral and memorial society, you can find out what's near you by going to funerals.org.
All right, and Bev wrote in, says, a tip from one premium ice cream lover to another, Clark. Have you ever tried Breyer's Gelato? It's awesome, many flavors to choose from, and I think you would love it.
I am always willing to accept the challenge to try a new flavor of ice cream, and I will try that one as well. You're listening to The Clark Howard Show. Thanks for joining us today. The Clark Howard Show is produced by Kim Drobes, Joel Larsgaard, Deborah Reese, and Jim Ayers. And remember, 24 hours a day, we're there to serve you at Clark.com and ClarkDeals.com.